Right. Let's take ourselves back in time for a moment. January 11th, 1959. We're in New York, in Upper Manhattan, in Washington Heights, in the Lamport Auditorium. So Lamport Auditorium holds about 1,100 people. And in Lamport Auditorium stood Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, blessed memory. If you open your packets on the inside, you see a picture of Rabbi Soloveitchik speaking in Lamport. And at the bottom, this is a picture of Lamport Auditorium, not from that event, but from later, but just so you can get a sense of what it was like. On that day, in January of 1959, as you see that week, the Kami, Hamachuna, the Kami, the YU student newspaper, the Commentator, describes the Rav delivers shiur to overflow crowd. Bottom right column. What was happening? The sanctity of the Sefer Torah, Tefillin, and Mezuzah were discussed by Rabbi Dr. Joseph B. Soloveitchik at the annual Yahrzeit shiur, January 11. The shiur commemorating the anniversary of the death 18 years ago of his father, Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik of blessed memory, was delivered to an overflow crowd at Lamport Auditorium. The assembled throng, including many of the Torah world's outstanding luminaries, Yeshiva University alumni, and present students of YU and other yeshivas. Rabbi Soloveitchik, descended from one of Judaism's greatest families, was granted the degree of Doctor of Philosophy by the University of Berlin in 1930. Upon entry into the U.S., Rabbi Soloveitchik founded the Rambam Yeshiva of Boston, Mass., which he now heads. That's what we call Maimonides School. He is also chairman of the Halacha Committee of the Rabbinical Council of America. At present, Rabbi Soloveitchik conducts the most advanced college shiur in Tractate Sanhedrin, and a class in Tractate Shabbat for students engaged in smicha studies. The Rav delivered the Yahrzeit shiur in memory of his father on Gimel Shvat, the third day of Shvat. This shiur was an event, as is described here in the article. Nechama's grandmother was married to the late Rabbi Rafal Pelkovitz, Rabbi Ralph Pelkovitz, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, and he told me that he was not a yeshiva student in YU. He was in Torah Vadas. That's where he had learned. And by this point, he was in the rabbinate. But he used to go to this annual Yahrzeit shiur. He said people sat in the shiur for 4 hours and no one moved. No one checked their cell phone. No one went to the bathroom. Nothing. 4 hours. The Rav spoke for 2 hours in halacha, in a legal Jewish law issue, and that's published in this volume called Shiurim, Lectures, Lezecher Abba Mori, in memory of my father, my teacher, Zatzal. This is one of two volumes. This is published by Mosada Rav Kook in the early 1980s. The halachic sections, the legal sections of the Rav's Yahrzeit Shiurim. This is volume one. This is the section called Ksiva Sefer Torah, Tefillin, and Mezuzah Lishma. That's the halachic section. But the Rav devoted 2 hours to agada, to homily, to a more philosophical message. There was a man in attendance of that Yahrzeit shiur who recorded the agada section, the homiletic section, the philosophical section of the Rav's epic Yahrzeit shiur in January of 1959. If you turn over your packet, you see the first installment of that recording. This is the Jewish week, the Yiddish Avach, $5 a year. I don't know if that's a lot or a little for a subscription. Irgun for religion. So take a look on the right-hand column. You see where it says Freitag Parshas Bo Zayin Shvat Tov Shin Yud Tes. Freitag is Yiddish for Friday. The 7th of Shvat, Erev Shabbos Parshas Bo Tov Shin Yud Tes. Right hand column. Groyser Torah Kinus, a great convocation of learning Torah. Suharav Yud Dalet Soloveitchik's Shir to Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik's Shir. Here you have the first installment of several pieces. It was like a series of sections writing up what Rav Soloveitchik spoke about in that Yahrzeit Shir. Years later, many years later, this was translated. Someone was gracious enough to share it to me. There was a Hebrew translation. First, there was a Yiddish publication of this. In the same volume, it's called the Beis Yosef Shol. It's going to be hard to find, but I can get it for you if you need it. Then there was a Hebrew translation. Then somebody connected to me to a guy who made an English translation of this. And you're wondering, why are we talking about this? But it'll become clear in a few minutes. So there was a guy, turn the page. His name is Shol Seidler Feller. I have no idea who that is, but he did a translation of this Yiddish rendering of Rav Soloveitchik's Yahrzeit Shir. And here is the beginning of the Yahrzeit Shir. A Jew is compared to a Torah scroll. This equation is axiomatic in halacha and agada. If I could, I would try to imitate Rav Soloveitchik's his voice with that very heavy Yiddish inflection. And you can imagine, at that time, this drasha was given all in Yiddish. But try to imagine his voice. Let us cite several examples, both halachic and agadic, of this very equation. The Gemara says in Shabbos, one who stands over a dying person at the time of the soul's departure is required to rend his garments. What we call, in Yiddish, you would say, reis kriya, to tear a person's garments, not just for a person's own relative, but if, Rachmana litzlan, God forbid, you were present when another Jewish person expired, totally unrelated to you, you would have an obligation to rip kriya for them. That's the din. Why? To what is this comparable? The Gemara says, to a Torah scroll which was burned. If a person, God forbid, saw a Torah scroll being burnt, they would have to rip their garments. And so too, if you see a Jewish person pass away, you have to rip your garments. When one is present at the death of a Jew, of every Jew, one must tear kriya. Why is this? For when a Jew passes away, a Torah scroll disappears along with his death. And at the burning of a Torah scroll, one is obligated to tear kriya. Rashi's words on the Gemara in Shabbos are interesting. One must rend one's garments when a Torah scroll is burned, as we say, Gemara says in Moed Katan, regarding the scroll which Yehoyakim, there was a wicked Jewish king whose name is Yehoyakim, who tore up a scroll and burnt it in the furnace in the wintertime that had been given to him by the prophet Jeremiah. He sent it with his scribe Baruch, and he took it and he burnt it. They did not fear, the people who were there, they didn't do anything. They saw the scroll being burnt in the fire, nor rend their garments. So too is the soul of an Israelite when it is taken similar to this, for there is no completely empty person in Israel who has no Torah in him, has not fulfilled any mitzvos. That's number one. Number two, in the Gemara Megillah it says, and Rava said, one who buries a Torah scroll which wore out, one buries it where? Next to a Torah scholar. Rambam rules that one places a Torah scroll which wore out or was invalidated into an earthenware vessel and buries it next to a Torah scholar. And that is called its geniza. You know, we call that contemporary. We call that Seamus. has the name of God, it's buried. When a Torah scroll is physically destroyed, one must bury it exactly as one buries a person who has died. A third example. The halachic requirement to stand up before a Torah scroll when it is carried is based on the mitzvah, before an elderly man you shall stand and you shall honor the countenance of an old man, which obliges each person to honor Torah scholars. Next page. The Gemara in Kiddushin regarding the requirement to stand up before a Torah scroll states as follows. It was asked, what is the halacha regarding standing before a Torah scroll? Reb Chilkia, Reb Shimon, and Reb Elazar would formulate an a fortiori argument. If one stands before those who learn it, should one not stand before the Torah itself? And finally, he gives more, but I'm going to give you one more. Just here, this is what he quotes. The identification of a living person with the Torah scroll is also symbolically demonstrated according to the halacha in another way. According to the law in the Gemara, at the time of the funeral procession of a Torah scholar, a Torah scroll must be carried out as well. The Gemara says in Bava Kamma, our rabbis taught they honored him in his death. This refers to King Chizkiyahu, upon whose bed they laid a Torah scroll, and they said, this one fulfilled what is written in this. And today, do we do so as well? We carry out the Torah scroll, but we do not lay it down. This was the Rav's Yahrzeit Drasha. The title of this drasha, as it was said over afterwards, is that a Jew is a Torah scroll. Every Jew is a Sefer Torah. Every Jew is a Sefer Torah. That was the theme of the Rav's homiletic component of this lecture. Why are we talking about this? It happens to be that this is a very powerful teaching and has many implications. But guess who was the writer? Who was the journalist who was present at the Yahrzeit Shir, who wrote it up in Yiddish for the Yiddish Avach? A man by the name of Dr. Hillel Seidman. Hillel Seidman. Hillel Seidman. And that's the man we're going to focus on today. And the reason why we start with this is not just because this piece from the Rav is incredibly powerful, but because I wonder if the Chiddush of the Rav, the Hesber of the Rav, the Vort of the Rav, is exactly the life message of Hillel Seidman. That was the lens through which he wanted us to understand the Holocaust. And let's understand why that may be the case. Hillel Seidman, he was born in Buchach in 1914. He got a secular education, which it complemented for him his rigorous Torah studies at a young age. He was reared in a Hasidic home in Galicia, but he was also educated in a secular environment. He got his PhD in 1939. I found this Yiddish blog where they put down some of the facts for his life. You can read it later on the next page. Hillel Seidman wrote 10 books in the years before the war. The reason why I wanted to talk about him today, actually, because he wrote a book about Sarah Schneer, who we talked about last time. He wrote a book about education in Poland, about the community in Warsaw, about dreaming of a Jewish state. He wrote many, many works about the yeshivas in Poland. He was an accomplished writer. He was also an incredible activist. There are several letters, not in this book, which we're going to get to in a minute, but in a different book, which I'll give you the title page for in a second in your packet. He got 3 letters from the Chafetz Chaim, 2 of them asking him for help with a certain resettlement visas for somebody else, because he was such an accomplished, people knew him. He was such an active guy that the Chafetz Chaim and Radin sent him a letter, can you help out these guys with such and such an issue? And then he got a thank you letter from the Chafetz Chaim. He has a letter from the Imre Emes and many other great European Gedolim, because he wasn't just an academic, He also was an activist. He was the head of the Warsaw, like the archives at the outbreak of the war, which gave him actually almost, not exactly diplomatic status, but quasi-diplomatic status to travel in and out of the ghetto after the Germans sealed it off, to be able to travel to the Aryan side, to the public library, which is interesting. He suffered terribly during the German occupation, being taken to prison and with family, everything you could imagine, lo aleinu. His parents gone, grandparents. But he managed to survive the war. He ended up getting papers. He was sent to a concentration camp in France. He was one of the few survivors of this concentration camp. He was liberated by the American Army in 1944. Subsequent to that, he met a young woman who had been involved in the Beis Yaakov movement. They married. He spent a short time in Israel in the early 1950s, and then he spent most of his life in New York. They had four children. Amazing. One of his daughters is a professor in Berkeley. You can go online. There was an interview that she did on YouTube. It's over an hour long. I didn't watch the whole thing, but it's fascinating. His daughter did an interview going through the course of his life with family photographs and tracing his activities. It's super worthwhile. Super worthwhile. At the end, there's a photograph of him, his family. They have like at a Hanukkah party in Lakewood. He died in 1995. He had like, it looks like 100 people in this family picture. You know, four children, not even all the children are there, grandchildren, like a huge, huge family. What was that?
He never got smicha.
He did not get smicha, although he was extremely, extremely knowledgeable. So he was Dr. Simon. What did he do primarily in the ghetto? He was a chronicler. He wrote a diary. And it's described in the Hakdama. This is the work. It's translated to English. It's very difficult to get, so I had to get it through interlibrary loan, called the Warsaw Ghetto Diaries. This is a Targum Press version of this. I have the Hebrew at home in a small. It was originally published shortly after the war, because when he was in the ghetto, he was writing furiously, nonstop. Half of the materials he buried in the ghetto, and half of it he had gone outside to the Aryan side, where he knew a guy who was holding it for him with some other papers. Then, unfortunately, the guy said he was worried that the Germans were going to find it, so they gave it back to him in the ghetto. He was taken to the Pawiak prison, and he was stopped on. It's a crazy story how a Polish policeman stopped him and took away his papers, and he was petrified. Turns out that the Polish guy was looking for money, so there was no money. So what did he do with the papers? He gave the diary to the Gestapo. So now he's really petrified. So the Gestapo sent a message to the ghetto to him. We'd like you to translate this for us. So what did he do? Chacham, a Yiddish Akab, Baruch Hashem. He was panicked. He would have been shot to death instantly, no question. He was able to get some other Hebrew papers. And when they gave him the papers, he substituted them out for some nonsense. And they translated and gave it back to the Germans. But meanwhile, he was able to take those papers with him to France. It's a whole crazy story. Now, Lamaisa, he comes back after the war and has both halves of the diary. It's an incredible story. So then he starts publishing shortly after the war, a few years after the war. This is one of the first, if I'm not mistaken, I think it is the first, but I can't say with certainty, the first diaries that are being written, that are being published, of people's contemporaneous experience during the war. This was still in the 1940s. So it sounds like he did his own archival work. He did his own diary. It does not sound like it was buried together with the Oneg Shabbos archives. He tells you in here the address of where he buried it. It was buried, he says, in the cellars of the Kehillah building in Zamenhof 19. So it doesn't sound like it was connected with Ringelblum. This was his own work, although he was definitely involved with lots of people in the ghetto. He was connected with Chernikov. He was a member of the Judenrat. He was very involved. Yes?
Well, why is it that, at what point did his diary come to the forefront? Because we're only talking about Ringelblum.
Yeah, so it's not, it's what's interesting, and one of the things which his daughter, who is this professor at Berkeley, notes, is that part of what makes this diary unique, aside from the fact that it's from the earliest ones, is the fact that it is being written from someone with a religious perspective. Historically, most Jewish history is written from a secular, at least in modern times, it's written from a secular Jewish perspective. So why this was not well known, I can't tell you, but it was being published in the 1940s already, and I'm sure in certain circles it was very well known. But this, it's amazing. It's incredible. But that's not even what I wanted to focus on today. Yes.
That's being written from the religious point of view. Was that covered in Mickey and Laurie's spiritual resistance? Because that's a point of resistance.
It certainly is. And they refer to a different chronicler who was at the same time in the same place who was working with Ringelblum. That was Rav Shimon Huberband.
Yeah.
So I don't know if they had much to do with each other because I didn't read the entire diary. But this idea of chronicling and writing down, he says there was a person in the ghetto that his name was Rav Chaim Leibish Burglass, who we mentioned once before in a different context. It's not, we don't have time for that today. He said that you need to keep writing, he said to Dr. Seidman. Every Jew always hopes to leave some memory, a son to say Kaddish, learn Mishnayos, observe a yard site. Other people, they write to Sfarim. Others endow a charitable gift. Others give them, they have a grave and a matzeva. But now there's no Kaddish, there's no grave, but at least there should be a record. So he wrote incessantly. So the diary is amazing. But that's not even what I want to talk about today. We should learn that too. But what do I want to talk about? The tshuva, the drasha, the principle that Rav Soloveitchik articulated. Because not only did Hillel Seidman write a diary, but he published a second section in the back. And this really hones in what I wonder if he wanted us to understand. What was his raison d'etre? What did he want to teach us, aside from the diary and all of his published works? The section is called Personalities I Knew in the Ghetto. What Hillel Seidman wants us to understand is not just the numbers of the Holocaust, and it's not just the narrative, the day-to-day diary of the events. He wants us to know the people, the Jews, their names. So that's why, if you turn the page in your packet, there's another book, which I'm just giving you, in Hebrew called the Sharblot, in Yiddish it was called the Sharblot, the title page. This was published later, 1970. Ishim Shehikarti. You see on the next page, people that I knew. People that I knew. Dmuyos, Me'aver Karov, Me'avar Karov, B'Mizrach Europa. People from recent history from Eastern Europe. This bottom left is a picture of Hillel Seidman. On the right side, when he was a young man with his father and grandfather. The picture, if you went back, if you go back to underneath Rav Soloveitchik, this is Rav Soloveitchik on the left side in his later years. This is the Israeli President Zalman Shazar. And this is Dr. Hillel Seidman. So going back to where we are on the title page, so this is Dr. Seidman when he's a young boy in Galicia. This is the book. What's the introduction? Bal Yehafech Tohom Haklaya L'Tohom Hanishia. We should not allow the Tohom Haklaya, the abyss of the annihilation, to turn into L'Tohom, to the abyss of Hanashaya, of forgetting. And therefore he says, I'm going to write you little biographies of each of these people, these individual Jews, these individual Sifrei Torah. You have to know who they were. They should not be forgotten. Their names, their lives. Why? He doesn't say it. but because the Rav said every Jew is a Sefer Torah. So we're going to cherish every single Jew. So he goes alphabetically. Rav Aaron Grodznitsky, Rav Avram Yitzchak Block, that's the Tells of Rosh Hashiva. Rav Aaron Wolkin, the Zakan Aaron, Rav Elchanan Wasserman, and on and on and on. It's a whole book. It's like 500 pages. Do you know what else he did? Remember years ago, I shared with you, I have 7 volumes of an encyclopedia called Ela Eskara of rabbinic personalities, people who were lost. Who was one of the chief editors, contributors, and movers and shakers behind the encyclopedia Ela Eskara? Hillel Seidman. Because it's not just enough to tell the whole story of where it started or where it ended. You have to know the people. So who does he put in there? The biographies of all these great Jews and their pictures and where they came from and what they wrote. And because every Jew is a Sefer Torah. That's, I think, a unique contribution. Those are the eyes through which Hillel Seidman wants us to look at the Holocaust. To look at it through the perspective of every Jew is a Sefer Torah. Focus on the individual stories, on the individual people. Many of these people I never heard of. And their memory would be gone. Their story would be lost. It would be the Tohom Anshaya. But it can't be. It shouldn't be. There has to be a remembrance. So for that, I got the English edition, and I hope that the publisher will not be so upset that I Xerox a few pages for you. But you can't get this book unless you buy it used for like $250. And I did not think that Xeroxing another 8 pages in full Hebrew was a great contribution to your library. Let's go with the English. All right? Maury, that's okay?
Yeah.
Good. So I want to share with you 3 personalities.
My rabbi says it's okay.
God, Baruch Hashem. Okay. You're not planning on using this for commercial purposes, are you?
No.
No. You're not going to sell this anywhere? Not putting it on eBay. Good. Okay. So then let's assume it's okay. So he gives us 3 perspectives, 3 people who maybe I never even heard of them. But when we learn them Torah, when we understand who they were, it's like taking a Sefer Torah out of the Aron Kodesh and hugging it. Because they don't have a grave. They don't have a monument. They don't have a marker. Many of them, they don't have svarim. But they have a story. And this is what Hillel Seidman wanted us to do. It's interesting that he was so active. He was a member of the Agudas Yisrael in Poland in Warsaw before the war. After the war, he just became a journalist. That was it. He wasn't an activist anymore. I'm not sure why. His daughter wasn't sure why. He was a unique cosmopolitan type of Jew who had the warmth and the love and the scholarship of a Hasidic upbringing with also an academic and intellectual cosmopolitan worldview. It's a very interesting synthesis here. So who does he tell us about? Let's go the first one. The Radomska Rebbe. Radomsk is a town in Poland. I think the first Radomska Rebbe was Rav Shlomo HaKohen Rabinowitz, 100 years before, 80 years before. Great Hasidic master, author of the Sefer called Tiferes Shlomo. So this is his descendant. Rav Shlomo Chanoch Rabinowitz. Rabinowitz, by the way, is a very common name in Eastern European rabbinic circles. Why? What does the name Rabinowitz mean?
Son of a rabbi.
That's right. Rabiner. Rabinovich. Son of the rabbi. So you'll find many, many rabbinic luminaries, they have the same last name. He was an unusual rebbe in many respects. Even when he was recognized as a prominent rebbe with thousands of chassidim, he would still personally travel to many other rebbes, particularly Rabbi Yisrael Chorkover, as if he were a simple chassid. You see his picture, beautiful smile. When he became rebbe in 1910 at the young age of 29, he had already been successful in business with interests in Berlin, Lodz, Warsaw, and Krakow. So that instead of accepting the customary donations from his chassidim, he was formerly far more likely to support his chassidim financially as well as spiritually. Although the Radomska Rebbe was a formidable Torah scholar blessed with a sharp brain and retentive memory, coupled with enormous diligence in study and prayer, he shrank from displaying his vast knowledge and eschewed all forms of pilpul. Despite his great knowledge, his great wealth, He spent very little on himself or his household, and he devoted most of his riches to a network of 36 yeshivas throughout Poland. Think of that, 36 yeshivas that he established under the title Keser Torah, which means the crown of Torah. And he notes here, Dr. Seidman, that unlike in Lithuania, where it was very popular to establish a network of high-level institutions of Jewish learning in yeshivas, it was not so common in Poland, but that was his visionary move. And he wasn't particular that his Rashi Yeshiva or the Bachrim be Radomsker Hasidim. Turn the page. Tap the next column. Notwithstanding the Radomsker Rebbe's display of robust health, he was quite a sick man, in fact, who was hospitalized many months a year with diabetes. During Shabbos and Yom Tovim, his tish had to be interrupted before Kiddush so that his physician could administer an insulin injection. He was greatly loved by Chassidim from both Poland and Galicia. And such was his own regard for all other groups and personalities that he steered clear of all politics and argument. The Radomska Rebbe's humility was legendary, yet carried off in so simple a manner as to render it hardly noticeable. When the war erupted, the Radomska Rebbe was in Galicia, residing at the Carpathian Mountains. He returned to Lodz, where his Hasidim urged him to escape on the last few air flights, but he refused, replying simply, "I want to be with all the Jews." He arrived with his family in Warsaw during Hanukkah that year and resided with his wealthy and learned chassid, Rav Nachum Dustin Pinchas Ehrlich, at 30 Nowolowipki Street. Throughout the ghetto's existence, regular minyanim took place in his apartment, and each Shabbos the Rebbe conducted a tish v'shalashudis. Many Hasidim would gather to hear the Rebbe's Divrei Torah. Just think about this in the context of what you know about Warsaw at that time. The Radomska Rebbe's diabetes had deteriorated, but he continued his tight schedule of Torah study, mainly by heart because of his failing eyesight. Every so often, plans were hatched to spirit the Rebbe out of danger, but the Radomska Rebbe firmly rejected them all with one standard refrain, I shall remain with my people. Even though he knew what that meant. Next column, go over to the top next. You can read some more at home. Despite the danger for religious Jews to appear on the streets, the Radomska Rebbe continued his unusual custom of visiting other Hasidic Rebbes. He also retained this tradition of generously supporting the needy, though he had been deprived of his vast wealth and was personally subsisting on loans. On that infamous Black Shabbos in the afternoon of the 18th of Av, 1942, a Wehrmacht battalion ran amok in his tenement block, going from apartment to apartment, ruthlessly shooting approximately 150 people. They brutally murdered the Rebbe, his wife, his daughter, and son-in-law. The Radomska Rebbe was buried within the Novominsker Oel at the Warsaw Cemetery. And the rest of the passage here, you could read on your own, is the incredible story of his son-in-law, who was killed on that same Shabbos. Turn the page to the next person I want to introduce you to. Totally different milieu, totally different personality. But every Jew is a Sefer Torah. And different Sefer Torah, the Gemara says in Maseches Bava Basra, have different sizes. They have different styles. They have different shapes. It's the same thing. He introduces us to Reb Yaakov Trokenheim. In countless forms, religious Jewry was ably represented by Reb Yaakov Trokenheim. On behalf of Agudas Yisrael, he was a member of the Warsaw Kehila and its president from 1926. Simultaneously, he was a member of the Warsaw Town Council for 20 years, from 1919 to 1939, a senator in the Polish parliament in the 1930s, and a member of the lower parliament. This is an Orthodox Jew in the Polish parliament. Not a Hasidic master, an Orthodox plain Jew. Surprisingly, Rabbi Yaakov Trokenheim was not a renowned orator or particularly erudite. Certainly, he possessed as much book learning as the average learned layman, but he was not famed as a scholar. Likewise, in common with most Polish Jews, he was no fount of secular knowledge, not one to initiate ideas or campaigns of his own. He was scrupulous about carrying out the plans of others. One can sum up his continuing popularity in one word: integrity. He never claimed to do more than his capability, And though he greeted everybody warmly and listened to their problems in detail, he made no rash promises. Even at election time, he did not frame any grand promises and was not fond of empty slogans. He had no false pretensions, fully recognizing his duty to those who voted him in. When he spoke in Parliament on Jewish issues, he used the simple everyday language of any ordinary businessman from Nalewki Street, Warsaw. Although he was well aware how publicity brought votes, nonetheless, where he felt the publicity would be counterproductive to those he was helping, he acted as discreetly as possible. He tells you that he was born in 1818. His father was a well-known Gerer Chassid. He married into a well-known family, a wealthy family in Lublin. And in 1919, he became a candidate for the Warsaw City Council. And so he was chosen as a counterbalance to somebody who represented more the Ashkenazim. So he was more of the Hasidic bent. He was very serious, so he never missed a sitting, a public sitting of the city council, always spoke on subjects affecting Jewish population. And then he talks about the rest of his term. Go to the next column. It says 379, same page, bottom paragraph. When the war broke out in 1939, Reb Yaakov Trokenheim fled to one of his sons in Vilna, where he set up a soup kitchen in cooperation with the joint, while his wife and two daughters stayed behind in Warsaw. He desperately tried to get a passport to America or to get to Israel. Go to the next page. Large print. When the Russians incorporated all three Baltic states into the Soviet Union, on June 24th, 1941, Vilna was captured by the Germans and the mass shootings began in the nearby Ponary Forest. You're familiar with that. Rav Yaakov Trokenheim fled to Bialystok until November. And then ultimately comes back together with his son to Warsaw. He stayed openly with his daughter who ran the Jewish hospital at 1 Lezhno Street in cooperation with Rav Zisha Friedman, who we spoke about in other times in this group, and Rav Yosef Konigsberg. He organized soup kitchens for yeshiva bachurim and scholars. By being registered as a clerk at the hospital, he managed to evade the early deportations, but March 1943, he was deported to the Panatova camp near Lublin, and he got a Paraguayan passport, but it didn't help. In 1943, he was deported to Majdanek and murdered. One last maisa, one last person. Rev Shimshon Stockhammer. Every Jew is a Sefer Torah. If I'm not mistaken, Rev Shimshon Stockhammer was one of those who was involved in encouraging armed resistance, like Rav Menachem Zemba, to support the uprising in the ghetto, if I'm not mistaken. I'd have to check. Rav Shimshon Stockhammer was a man of many talents. He was born in 1899 in Sokol, Galicia, where his father was a Belzer Chassid, was a Talmud Chacham, and a Shoichet. The young Shimshon learned at the local Belzer Klois, which means that was the shtiebel, that was the house where he learned, and delivered an astounding drush at his bar mitzvah on the brink of World War I. Later, he visited the Belzer Rebbe a number of times. At the age of 20, he received ordination. So he had smicha, he had ordination. In 1925, he married into a rabbinical family in the outskirts of Warsaw and became close with Rav Menachem Zemba, the genius of Praga, who we've spoken about before. We're not going to talk about him today. Why not? Because I dafka wanted to explore people and learn about people who we don't know about, who we never heard of. Because every Jew is a Sefer Torah, even if we never heard of them. And look at how incredible these people were. He was a facile writer both in Yiddish and Hebrew and authored numerous articles in the Agudah's daily and weekly newspapers. So Rav Stockhammer had a regular column on Kashrus or Shabbos in the weekly Togblat, which was the Yiddish newspaper. Top of the next column. Since 1878, with the passing of Rav Yaakov Gesundheit, that's a real name, by the way, Warsaw had not had a chief rabbi. Only seven rabbis operated within the Warsaw rabbinate, ostensibly catering for the largest European kehillah, approximately 170,000 Jews. So in 1934, Rav Yaakov Trockenheimer, we just spoke about, and Rebbe and Elio Mazer tried to change this. They were trying to figure out what to do. Finally, they appointed a group of new Rabbanim, including Rav Shimshon Stockhammer. He continued to work in the areas of Shabbos and Kashrus. And unusual for a Belzer Chassid, he took an active role in the Polish Aguda. When the Germans captured Warsaw in October 1939, Rav Stockhammer was residing in the Praga suburb. We mentioned before, Rav Menachem Zemba, he was from Praga. They were close. Working together with Rav Meshulam Kaminer, Rav Yitzchak Ber Ackerman, Rav David Shapira, he displayed hitherto unknown reserves of dedication as one of the few religious voices on the Judenrat, trying to protect the Orthodox masses. The devout Jews were the hardest hit in the ghetto. Their distinctive, turn to the next page, distinctive appearance, their lifestyle and mitzvah observance made them an obvious target for the accursed Germans. Communal organizations also discriminated by employing very few Orthodox Jews among the thousands working for them. The religious did not enjoy the relative safety afforded by Judenrat or joint employment and received little financial support. Since Rav Stockhammer wielded far less influence than the assimilationists who filled the most important posts, he required strenuous effort to help those in need, yet he turned no one away. So we know that in the summer of 1942, the big deportations began. So he went into hiding with his family, but he was captured during Shvat of 1943, and his wife and children had already been taken away, and he was deported to the Poniatowa camp near Lublin. From there, he was transferred to Flossenbürg. He survived there for a year. Describes here, this is unbelievable. During Pesach 1945, he subsisted on water alone for 8 days rather than eat chametz. He managed to keep up with the slave labor despite his prolonged weakness and emaciation. When fellow camp inmates remonstrated that he ought not to endanger his life by abstaining from the daily ration of bread, he replied that at least one Jew out of the 2,500 imprisoned in Flossenbürg ought to observe Pesach, and he was glad to be that lone Jew. A month after Pesach, at the approach of the Russian army, the Germans moved their Jewish prisoners westward. The train they were traveling on was frequently bombed by Allied aircraft, and Rav Stockhammer was critically wounded by a piece of shrapnel. He never recovered and died on the 13th of ER 1945, 3 days before liberation. It's hard to talk when you read stories like this. What are you going to say? The only thing I could say is what Hillel Seidman wrote from the Rav from the Yahrzeit Drasha, that every Jew is a Sefer Torah. Every Jew is a Sefer Torah. And that's what he wanted us to do. As an archivist, as a chronicler, as a journalist, Hillel Seidman was a storyteller, and he wanted us to tell stories. He wanted us to remember the people, these Sefer Torah. And hopefully, by looking at the Holocaust through his eyes of realizing at every turn that each Jew is a Sefer Torah and their story needs to be told, we can keep retelling these stories. We can keep learning more and more stories of these individuals so that we can perpetuate their legacy, to appreciate, to realize that every Jew really is a Sefer Torah.